spend the honour of our Prophet, and we will lay our life on the line.
It's upsetting to basically put a film up like that that's dividing the Muslim community.
So far, the film has been a flop. Reports suggest it has performed poorly in the US, and a counter-petition demanding support for the film accumulated a mere 2,500 signatures. However, protest leaders say they won't stop the fight until the film is dropped from all British cinemas. Robert Carter, Birmingham.
Mercenaries fighting for the Ukrainian armed forces. By their accents, it's clear they're from English-speaking countries. Indeed, there are reported to be at least hundreds of fighters from NATO countries currently on the ground in Ukraine. Some are there to teach their allies how to use the billions of dollars worth of weaponry sent over the border. Less clear are the roles of the mercenaries fighting on the front line, particularly former special forces. In the opening days of the war, three British special forces were reported feared dead by a Russian missile strike. And this is Ben Grant, former Royal Marine Commander, son of a serving Conservative British Member of Parliament. He recently posted footage of himself at the front.
As for the mercenaries, they have two roles. Some were working as instructors and some were paid to fight here. When we provided evidence, like the documents of those people killed from NATO countries, their home countries said that they were here in the status of a private person. But it sounds hard to believe when somebody is an army officer of that army and all of a sudden he's become a private citizen.
There's also been controversy over this man, Trevor Cadieux, a former Canadian general. He is known to have gone to Ukraine to fight and is rumoured to be amongst those who surrendered at Azovstal. Yeah. Edward Basurin told me that he thinks the Russians have him and are keeping it quiet as a negotiating tool. But there is no evidence of this. Cadieux's current whereabouts are still unknown.
Russia famously warned that any country which would help Ukraine in this war will face harsh consequences, and America and NATO probably don't want to push Russia's patience to the limit, but they do want to provoke Russia, they want to confuse Russia, they want to disturb Russia, they want Russia to be confused how and if to respond.
Now, it's not just high-tech weapons and trainers on the ground, it's also military intelligence that the United States is giving Ukraine in order to help them kill Russian soldiers. But where does this line lie between helping an ally and indeed becoming a co-belligerent? Indeed, that grey zone is becoming increasingly and dangerously blurred.
Bruce Fain, a constitutional expert, recently said, "The United States and several NATO members have become co-belligerents with Ukraine against Russia by systematic and massive assistance to its military forces to defeat Russia. One wrong political move and the fighting in Ukraine could quickly become a war between Russia and NATO." Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
In the past week, Kashmir witnessed two targeted killings. A non-local bank manager from the western Indian state of Rajasthan and a Kashmiri Pandit school teacher. Fear has once again gripped the troubled valley region, and local minority Hindus, known as Kashmiri Pandits, fear a repeat of the 1990s scenario. Back then, the minority group left the valley region after a series of targeted killings of high-profile officials. At that time, full-blown insurgency against Indian rule had begun in Kashmir, and the Muslim-majority population was up in arms against the Indian rule and sought independent Kashmir or a merger with Pakistan. Scores of families who had returned to Kashmir Valley after a relief and rehabilitation package was announced by the Indian Prime Minister in 2010 are once again seeking an exit from the trouble-torn valley and blame the government for faking normalcy in Kashmir.
We left in 1990 for the sake of our lives. Under the Prime Minister's package, which promised jobs and accommodation, we were lured back. But what is the fun of that job when our lives are at stake? In Kashmir, nobody is safe, and they say it's normal. We want the government to relocate us to safer places. We can't move out of our homes because of fear. Is this what you call life?
Since the abrogation of Kashmir's semi-autonomous status in August 2019, there has been a sharp rise in attacks against Kashmiri Pandits and non-locals. In Muslim-majority Kashmir, for centuries, Hindus and Muslims have lived side by side in harmony. However, the political turmoil in the region in the early 1990s forced more than 250,000 Kashmiri Hindus to flee. Kashmiri Muslims support the return of Hindus to the valley, however, oppose the idea of separate settlements being given to them.
We are Kashmiri people. To us, Hindu and Muslim make no difference. We always want them to return and stay alongside Muslims. We are secure with each other.
Since Kashmir's special status was eroded in 2019, Prime Minister Narendra Modi's BJP government has implemented new laws and policies that local Muslims say aim to change the demographics of the region.
You cannot be ruled from the center, and that too in a sensitive area like Jammu and Kashmir. This has been an utter disaster and utter failure, not today, right from the time the governor's rule has been imposed here.
Kashmir Valley is the world's largest militarized zone. Estimates say more than 500,000 Indian soldiers are stationed in the valley. After the fresh spate of violence, New Delhi has ordered reinforcement ahead of the annual Hindu pilgrimage. Suspecting more targeted attacks, security has been beefed up in and around Kashmir. Amid mounting tensions, the Indian administration has denied the relocation demand of Kashmiri Hindus. However, fearing a repeat of 1990s, many have already started to flee the region, saying their lives matter and no politicking in the name of Kashmiri Pandits. Shahana Bhatt, Indian Administered Kashmir.
More than three decades have passed, but Imam Khomeini and his ideas still touch the hearts of revolutionaries. People remember him as a symbol of anti-imperialism and anti-oppression. Imam Khomeini was a man who changed the world's perception about religion and paved the way for those who want to free themselves from the grasp of imperialism. People in the port city of Karachi have gathered in remembrance of Imam Khomeini and his ideas.
The charisma of Imam Khomeini not only inspired Iranians but had strong impact on hearts and minds of people all across the globe. That's why gatherings like these are held across the country by his lovers to show respect for the late leader.
Both Sunni and Shia scholars have stressed the need for unity among Muslims, which is one of the key teachings of Imam Khomeini.
Imam Khomeini raised the voice and the slogan that no East and no West. That is the spiritual and that is the real slogan which inspired to the nations, to other nations, especially as a Pakistani nation, we are very much inspired from this slogan and this point.
Participants also chanted anti-US and anti-Israel slogans. People emphasize the real identity of the Muslim Ummah that has been distorted and tarnished by certain enemies of Islam. They believe in the Islamic identity that Imam Khomeini has introduced to the world.
We think the way and the thoughts of Imam Khomeini must be spread all around the world between Islamic people in order to make the Islamic countries more stronger and to, inshallah, to beat the enemies of the Islamic people around the world.
Imam Khomeini is the late founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, who led the 1979 revolution against the Shah. He is widely respected among Muslims for his teachings and views on freedom and unity. He is also admired for his efforts towards the Palestinian cause. Mohammad Turi, Karachi.
Following intense UN-supervised meetings between the warring sides in Yemen, the UN envoy for Yemen announced that the parties have agreed to renew the current truce in Yemen for two more months. The truce is extended under the same terms as the original agreement, which first came into effect on the 2nd of April.
When the United Nations agreed to our conditions, which included releasing the salaries of government employees, we saw that it was our duty to respond to the renewal of the truce, although we were aware that the enemy would not respect the truce as it did previously. But we adhere to peaceful solutions and we will make concessions in order to end the war.
Observers say renewing the truce is a win for the Yemenis, who stood alone during 7 years of war without any support from the international community or the United Nations.
The United Nations was absent throughout the years of war, and the armistice is not an achievement for the international body, but rather a success for Sana'a, which remained alone in facing war and siege without any support from the international community or any allies.
Grundberg said he will continue engaging with the parties to implement and consolidate all elements of the truce.
People, he hoped that renewing the UN brokered truce will build for a comprehensive political solution to end the war that devastated their lives and country. They say the international community should now step in properly to support the political process in Yemen. Abdul Latif Al Washali, Sana'a.
France's government has warned, don't expect inflation to return to normal until the end of 2023. At nearly 6%, French inflation is the highest since 1985, and the government says the peak won't even be reached until this winter. It's a stunningly serious diagnosis. Inflation has seemingly been the number one voter complaint since the euro currency was introduced in 1999, and now it's worse than ever. Many are pointing the finger at the pan-European project, with Brussels demanding austerity and forcing Paris to ignore mass protests and public opinion.
This inflation is a symptom of the profound crisis caused by the policies of neoliberalism put in place since the 1980s. Above all, the policies seek merely to enrich stockholders and create constant dividends. This inflation is going to last, and the government is only making a wild guess that it will end by 2024.
Across the EU, only Malta has managed to keep inflation lower. France has been saved by its constantly derided socialist-inspired measures, such as caps on energy prices. However, many are demanding more price caps, re-indexed pensions, immediate bonuses, higher wages across the board, and especially for low-wage workers, in order to keep inflation from making the poverty rate skyrocket.
All the countries of the European Union are basically already in a recession. The 2008 financial crisis was followed by a forced era of austerity, which created a structural lack of demand and investment in Europe. Making massive public investments with efforts to an ecological transition would create both jobs and demand for goods and possibly avoid another Great Depression.
80% of France says they're watching their expenses more carefully, which seems likely to push France's consumer-driven economy officially into a recession next quarter. 70% are distrustful of their economic future, which is record pessimism so soon after a presidential election. After all the austerity, the French are being told to expect nearly 2 years of widespread economic hardship. That may not only affect this month's legislative elections, but it could lead to major social unrest yet again. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
...150 foreign ambassadors and officials have visited Tehran to take part in the 33rd anniversary of the passing away of a man who changed the course of history in Iran, Imam Khomeini. Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini was the founder of the Islamic Republic and the former leader of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, which put an end to centuries of autocracy in Iran. Here, people believe the scale of Imam Khomeini's impact transcends Iran's boundaries.
The Islamic Revolution of Iran has proved to the Nigerian populace that if you are determined to eliminate any unjust leader and you follow the course, you can reach a result. In some of the curriculum of the higher education in Nigeria, there are some space being open for Imam Khomeini to talk about the Imam Khomeini and the revolution of Islamic Republic in Nigeria curriculum of education.
Thanks to Imam Khomeini, we have witnessed a freedom-seeking movement forming in Muslim and even non-Muslim nations, which challenges imperialism and encourages dignity and independence from the global arrogance. This is the miracle of the Islamic Revolution.
Imam Khomeini passed away in 1989 at the age of 86, almost a decade after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, which saw the overthrow of the U.S.-backed Pahlavi regime in Iran, headed by Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, known as the Shah. Imam Khomeini spent many years in exile in Iraq, Turkey, and France, from where he led a swelling grassroots movement, which ultimately ousted the Shah and led to the formation of the Islamic Republic.
For us, Imam Khomeini is a role model of resilience in the face of injustice. Today, we have come to renew our allegiance with him and the lessons that he taught us about self-reliance and resistance against the bullies of the world.
Imam Khomeini established the Islamic Republic following a referendum held in 1979, when, based on official reports, more than 98% of eligible voters voted yes to the Islamic Republic.
Imam Khomeini is remembered here as the pioneer of a new era in Iran's history, an era that put centuries of monarchy behind and upended the Shah's domestic and foreign policies, replacing them with a political system that tries to rule the country based on the motto of independence from the West. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید. ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we discussed Imam Khomeini's advice on political groups, particularly the parties affiliated to the West and the East, urging them to give up enmity against the Islamic system and joining the nation. This time, we are going to touch upon his advice to writers and speakers who unfairly used to weaken the Islamic Republic and the strenuous efforts of the nation. Stay tuned, please. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, used to advise writers, speakers, and so-called intellectuals who would try to divert the course of the Islamic Republic toward the big powers and trivialize the goals achieved by the nation, especially martyrs and their selfless families. He writes in his testament, "My advice to writers, speakers, intellectuals, and those who forge false is that, instead of spending your time against the course of the Islamic Republic and doing your best in suspicion, ill wish, and ill speaking towards the parliament, government, and other servants to lead the country to the superpowers, have your lonely moments with your God for one night, and if you don't believe in God, have lonely moments with your conscience and examine your inward motive to see by which criterion and furnace you ignore the blood of these youth in the fronts and cities. You have staged nervous war against the nation who want to get rid of the yoke of oppressors and external and internal looters, and selflessly preserve the independence and freedom which they have achieved by sacrificing their lives and the lives of their dear ones. You are fomenting sedition and treacherous conspiracies and open the way for the arrogant and oppressors. Is it not better if you would guide the governments and the parliaments and the nation with your thoughts, pen, and speech for safeguarding the country? Would it not worth for you to help this oppressed and deprived nation and to assist to stabilize the Islamic establishment? Imam Khomeini, elsewhere in his testament, addressing the writers and speakers, says, "Do you consider this parliament, president, government, and the judiciary worse than what was there during the former regime? Have you forgotten the oppressions that damned regime used to enforce against this oppressed nation? Don't you know that the Islamic country was a military base for America and it used to be behaved like a colony and the parliament, the government and the military forces were in their control? And what their advisors, industrialists and specialists would do to this nation and their reserves? Has it escaped your memory, the promotion of indecency all over the country and the centers of corruption, including the brothels, gambling houses, bars, cinemas, and other centers, each of which was a great factor to corrupt the young generation? Have you forgotten the totally corruption-inducing mass media and magazines and the newspapers of that regime?" The founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran castigated the March 3, 1981 events in which then-President Abul Hassan Bani Sadr had deceived a handful of gullible elements and naive youths to change the course of the Islamic Revolution toward the West by murdering innocent people and revolutionary students in Tehran University. The Imam said, "Do you link and shake brotherly hands with those who explicitly condemn Islam and have staged armed rebellion against it or have embarked on rebellion with pen and tongue, which is more regrettable than armed uprising? And do you call those whom God has described as worthy of being killed as apple of eyes and sit beside the players who created the disaster of March 3rd and beat innocent youth to death and watched the event? Is this an Islamic and ethical act? And has the practice of the government and the judiciary, which have duly punished the opponents, deviant and heathens, caused you to shout in defense of the innocent? I regret for you, brothers, whose past record I know to some extent, and I am interested in some of you, but not for those who were wicked ones in the guise of benevolence and were wolves in the garb of shepherd and players who had ridiculed everyone and were hell-bent on corrupting the country and the nation and were serving one of the looting poles, those who wickedly martyred the valuable youth and men and ulema training the society, and had no mercy on innocent Muslim children. These people have scandalized themselves in the society and before the all-dominant God and have no way to return as the Satan of the soul, prompting to evil, is ruling them."
Thank you.
Imam Khomeini writes elsewhere in his testament as he addresses writers and speakers, "You faithful brothers, why don't you help the government and parliament which are trying to serve the deprived and oppressed, and you are just complaining? Have you compared the scale of service of the government and foundations of the Islamic Republic with the hardships and disorders which are natural for every revolution? And have you compared the imposed war with so much damage and millions of foreign and domestic homeless and excessive sabotages during this short period with construction activities of the former regime? Don't you know that the construction activities of that time were limited nearly to cities and that to the wealthy neighborhoods, and the poor and deprived people enjoyed little and nothing of those things? While the current government and the Islamic foundations are serving this deprived stratum wholeheartedly, you, the faithful, support the government so that the affairs are fulfilled soon, so that you may go to the Lord's presence, which you will go willy-nilly with the badge of serving his servants."
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, has begun its regular Board of Governors meeting in Vienna. With Iran's nuclear issue and Tehran's cooperation with the UN nuclear watchdog expected to take center stage, although the agency has said that Iran's cooperation with the agency remains, well, a lot to be desired. To put it in other words, its tone critical, however, stopping short of an outright resolution against Iran, at least for the time being. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at the double standards of the agency and whether the failing maximum pressure campaign adopted by the E3, along with the U.S. at its side, will lead to the derailment of the talks. But first, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Journalist and political analyst Seyed Mostafa Hoshchesh joins us from Tehran. Also joining us, academic and political analyst Tohid Asadi, who also joins us from Tehran.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Jamal, welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, Seyed Mostafa Hoshchesh, if I may. And perhaps you can give us a lesson in English and define for us what this means, this particular verb that I'm about to tell you. Reading off what the news has said, major European countries and the U.S. are expected to seek to censor Iran. Now, I looked up censor in the dictionary. It says express severe disapproval of someone or something, especially in a formal statement. But maybe you can put that into perspective for us, what it means.
Okay. Hello, and thanks for having me. Let me explain it this way. An IAEA Board of Governors resolution that they have warned to adopt could produce various results that vary from just censuring Iran and reprimanding to the worst-case scenario, sending and referring Iran's case to the UN Security Council, voting on revival of sanctions, which would definitely receive the Chinese and the Russian vetoing and would lead to nowhere, producing no result for the Americans and Europeans. So it's a political show with no action and with no, you know, result in perspective. Because if they really meant action, they wouldn't need adopting a resolution at the IAEA. They could simply resort to a faster, easier way to go for the trigger mechanism, which would refer the case to a UN Security Council veto-proof voting on the revival of sanctions, which would put an end to the Vienna talks, put an end to the JCPOA, and that's it. So it's no strange that they have gone for a political circus show. Because after the Iranian initiative last month made Borrell and Mora of the European foreign policy chief, actually, and his deputy happy for a few hours when he was returning from Iran to Europe, and he, until he received the similar no bullying response of the United States to push the talks into a deadlock, Washington has been using its worn-out instruments and scenarios that have been in use for the past four decades against Iran, including resorting to cyber attacks, resorting to media warfare, promoting the weak opposition as if they've never been supporting them and they've just started supporting them, just to magnify, you know, the impact of their propaganda, and using Israel for cyber terror and sabotage attacks, and the last one being the threat to adopt an IAEA resolution, all for one purpose: levy political pressure through these worn-out scenarios to make Iran retreat in the Vienna talks.
Okay.
Iranian response, definitely we'll talk about it later.
Sure. Well, let's take a look at what Rafael Grossi has said, the IAEA Director General, Toyed Esadi. He came out when the Board of Governors began and basically repeating his anti-Iran rhetoric. He made some allegations that since February 23, 2021, the agency activities have been seriously affected by Iran's decision. But what's very interesting, if you go to the IAEA website, there's a page where it says joint statement by Mohammad Islami, the VP and president of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, and Mr. Rafael Grossi, where it says the AEOI and the IAEA have agreed in the continuation of the cooperation as stated in the joint statement of 26 August of 2020. So I said all that, meaning that both in the IAEA state website have acknowledged cooperation, yet Rafael Grossi comes on and says, we're not getting the cooperation that is required. Can you please explain to us the discrepancy here, as I stated?
Yeah. First of all, thank you very much for having me. And secondly, as Said Mustafa was mentioning in a very correct way, there is a wide spectrum of evidence to put forth the claim that the performance, the decisions, and the courses of action that we have been observing from as far as IAEA is concerned, actually, all in all, if you just take a look at what they are doing, it is a clear indicative of the very fact that the behavior is quite unstable and under impact of a range of or a set of determinants that shouldn't be. So basically, when we're talking about IAEA, we are talking about a so-called technical body, international body, which should set its decisions on the basis of technical issues. But in practice, when it comes to the decisions that we see pertaining to Iran, most of the time, these decisions are made on the basis of political considerations, and these kinds of discrepancies, this kind of paradoxes that you see and you properly refer to, are coming basically from this basis. We know that there is a clear lack of partial performance when it comes to IAEA due to the influence of third parties, regimes like Israeli regime, the United States, and other actors and players which try to put their political will and impose their political will upon IAEA. So the result is that we see less technical, reports and more political reports from the side of this international body. The consequence, of course, as far as the Iranian side is concerned, is that such a performance could easily kill the trust of Iranians, and I think it has already done that. And if they decide to act on their right minds and just provide a better circumstances, not only for the ongoing talks in Vienna, which again, due to such decisions, faced a kind of, stopping due to such courses of action. But also if they really try to prove the world that they are such an independent organization, they have to reconsider their decisions. And it is not really limited to Iran. Just take a look at Israel and take a look at how IAEA faces this regime, regardless of all things that we know about the nuclear facilities of this brutal regime. So I think it goes without saying that the unstable behavior and this zigzagging policy formulation, zigzagging decisions that are coming from IAEA are all showing that it's not an independent body which right. should trust it. And this double standards that said Mustafa properly mentioned is observable in a tangible way in the performance of this international body.
Before we continue with the rest of our discussion, I have to ask you, Sayyid Mustafa Khoshesh, about the new sanctions that were announced by the U.S. Treasury
Department, which is somewhat confusing because the press release says members of the Terrorist Financing Targeting Center, TFTC, sanctioned 16 individuals, entities, and groups. And then it says all of these targets have been previously designated by the U.S., and they include three individuals associated with Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, GLITS Force. Can you explain these sanctions for us and why they're coming at this time when the Board of Governors meeting began?
Well, it's completely clear, as I explained the first question, response to the first question. They're using every possible means. That's why, actually, I said these are worn-out scenarios and instruments, because they are now copy-pasting these sanctions. It started under Donald Trump in order to build up different layers, actually four layers of similar sanctions. Sometimes they vary in names and in wording, but the purpose is the same. Sometimes the sanction is altogether the same, just to leave psychological impact on Iran first. Second, to remove one of these layers under a possible deal and keep the similar sanctions actually with similar impacts and effects in place so that Iran cannot benefit from any kind of deal and will be forced to go for JCPOAs over its other power components like the missile industry and regional power. But it's quite a notorious move. Just last week at a Senate hearing, Rand Paul also made similar, statements similar to what you just said, that if you're dealing with Iran, you need to show goodwill. It's called, even from the American perspective, it's called carrot and stick. He was objecting, he's a Republican, he's an American senator, and he's not on the side of Iran. He was saying, okay, you've always shown the stick side, like Donald Trump, you've never shown any kind of carrot. If you really are honest in talks with Iran, you need to remove part of the sanctions and ask Iran to join for further negotiations to discuss, the deal. But he said, you have just declared, and he was speaking to Rob Mali, the UN envoy in Iran, that you have just declared new rounds of sanctions, similar sanctions that you just mentioned. They were first declared by Rob Mali in a Senate hearing last week, and Rand Paul was objecting to this kind of policy. They do not really mean, to remove the sanctions. They have never meant that, because they do not mean to resolve the conflict with Iran. This has already been proved under six agreements with Iran in the past 22 years.
Okay.
The JCPOA was the sixth one. What they want is not a conflict resolution. They want to contain Iran. This is called the containment strategy. So they reinvigorate the sanctions, do the copy-pasting in order to keep them in place.
Right. Well, let's take a look at what the AEOI chief has said, Iran's AEOI chief here, Tohid Asari, concerning two issues which Rafael Grossi has mentioned, which appears to be the two sticking points, if you want to call it that. Of course, there's always a sticking point, even if things get clarified. But one of them has to deal with the idea that Rafael Grossi says these nuclear particles were found in three alleged nuclear sites. You have the AEOI chief saying that Rafael Grossi does not have serious will to admit that Iran's answers are convincing. And he also, on that issue, said that the IAEA invokes intelligence reports provided to it by Iran's enemies with the Israeli regime at the top. He gave those two answers, but it seems like answers were given on these alleged nuclear particles that they're talking about. The other has to deal with the cameras, of which Eslami said, we have already made it clear to the IAEA that access to this surveillance data and recordings depends on the fate of the agreement, the JCPOA. Sounds like he's given his answers. Why is the IAEA still pursuing the path on these two issues?
Well, let me just touch upon the idea of sanctions and U.S. sanctions for just a few sentences. I'm going to get back to that question immediately. But I think when we're talking about the United States foreign policy pertaining to Iran, we're talking about a wider grand strategy rather than small tactics. So when we're talking about sanctions, when we're talking about imposing some statements on international bodies, these are all part of a bigger or let's say wider toolbox in the foreign policy behavior of the United States. And this is part of a maximum pressure that Trump started. And now after this isolationism of the United States, they are trying with Biden administration to expand the scope of it to other countries in order to share the burden of this maximum pressure and then have other players involved in it. So that's just one point that I wanted to add. But getting back to your question, I think we see a really paradoxical behavior from the side of IAEA. Of course, part of this paradox, as far as I know, comes from the very fact that most of the reports, most of the statements that we hear from these so-called international bodies and their, let's say, key people, does not really come from the truth and the realities on the ground, but they are coming from some baseless, accusations and baseless claims that Israeli regime provides them with. And this is part of the obnoxious foreign policy that Israelis and the Americans are following when it comes to Iran. And you see the realization of these policies when it comes to IAEA reports or other similar statements. So if you're looking for the reasons behind it, you shouldn't really look for it in Iran, but you have to just take a look at the false, baseless, irrelevant, lines of argument that mm-hmm. has, irrelevantly met in the Israeli regime. But as far as the camera and in a broader context, as far as the Iran's permissions for IAEA to have access to its nuclear facilities are concerned, the truth, again, is that Iran has shown for the past years, and particularly after JCPOA was signed and sealed back in 2015, all these years and for the years even down the road, we can say that Iran has shown and will show a kind of extraordinary flexibility to giving access to the cameras and other things.
Exactly.
Extraordinary monitoring here. But regardless of this huge amount of being cooperative, what we see in response, which is quite disappointing, is such negative statements that we hear and we see from the, key people in these sure. international organizations.
And I'm glad you mentioned that, because the cooperation is out there, and even the IAEA has acknowledged the cooperation that Iran has had, and Sayed Mostafa Khoshesh, everybody knows, I'm hoping, that is, at this point, that the IAEA's inspection is one of the hardest and toughest and most extensive. So why do you have the IAEA Director General, of which it seems like they're cherry-picking his statements, say, since they, Iran, are continuing with the process to enrich uranium, well, then it's a matter of just a few weeks to get enough material to create a nuclear bomb, where in reality, an expert says weaponizing will still take 1 to 2 years.
More, even more, because weaponizing nuclear materials comes in three phases. First is producing uranium, enriching uranium above 93.4%. Second, means of delivery. And then the third phase is minimizing, the needed material into a small space and weaponizing it so that it detonates and creates the impact. So it needs three steps. It takes a long, long way for any country to do that. So the answer is pretty well clear. Iran has been under the harshest regime of inspections before the JCPOA and after the JCPOA, and they've never found a shred of evidence. But on the eve of the JCPOA endorsement, the ex-IAEA Director General, Yukio Amano, was asked if he would declare Iranian nuclear program to be completely peaceful based on the contents of the JCPOA. There are two ways that this dossier is ended. One, waiting for 10 years for a final decision of the major powers in Iran, or 2 years before that, on the eighth year, if the IAEA declares that Iran is pursuing a completely peaceful nuclear program, then everything is ended, everything will be normalized, and done is done. And the former IAEA Director General said, even if it's proved to us, we will not declare that, because Iran's case is no way a legal technical issue. It's a political issue. The superpowers should make the decision. That is very much telling. The IAEA is not an independent body. It's an instrument, like many other UN affiliated bodies. It's an instrument for the United States to expand its hegemonic rule and to maintain its hegemonic rule. Otherwise, why should the IAEA Director General rely on one main source, that's Israel, that's a sworn enemy of Iran, sworn enemy of the JCPOA? It's not a member of the IAEA. It's not under international surveillance and monitoring and inspections.
Okay.
And while it is suspected of having 200 to 400 nuclear warheads, it's an aggressive regime. It's a killer regime. It's an occupying regime. It has been defying UN members' calls, UN Security Council decisions, and it's a very irresponsible and aggressive regime. Why should it be the source of the IAEA and the IAEA Director General?
Very good question.
Travels to the Israel on the eve of the IAEA meeting on Iran.
Right.
It's sending this message that we are also an instrument of the United States. If you don't do what we want, what the U.S. wants, we increase the pressure. And Iranian response is very clear. Under President Raisi's administration, the policy is active resistance and also muscle flexing and show of power. The hit and run era is gone. If you do any hostile move to us, it will be reciprocated with responses twice tougher, twice more. That was shown in the case of the crude supply of Iran that was seized by the Greek when Iran seized two Greek ships. So I'm here to promise you, I know you're short of time, but let me give you this final sentence. Maybe we won't have time for the next question. If they ratify a resolution at the IAEA on Wednesday, they will receive a response twice more tougher, twice more and twice tougher in a matter of 24 hours. The United States knows from the Greek seizure and Iranian seizure of Greek ships.
What do you think that would be?
It was declared the policy would of Iran, the resistance and the muscle flexing policy was displayed. It was declared by Iran in that story, which happened a few weeks ago, that the hit and run era is gone. Iran's responses would not be balanced. It would be twice more.
Okay.
And the Iranian responses will come in two, three eras. One, nuclear. Two, other power components, including missile industry or regional power. From these three areas, definitely Tehran would provide them with a response in a matter of 24 hours.
Very well. Unfortunately, we've got to end it there.
The Iranian threats are credible, and they would probably retreat into a statement rather than a resolution against Iran.
Very well. We're fresh out of time. Thank you for that, Seyed Mostafa Khoshesh, journalist and political analyst. Toyda Sadi, thank you, academic and political analyst, both from Tehran. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight from Mikhail Tapovets. Goodbye.